This is Audible.
Parshat Audio presents
The Blade Itself from the First Law series by Joe Abercrombie, read by Stephen Pacey. The End. Logan plunged through the trees, bare feet slipping and sliding on the wet earth, the slush, the wet pine needles, breath rasping in his chest, blood thumping in his head. He stumbled and sprawled onto his side, nearly cut his chest open with his own axe, lay there panting, peering through the shadowy forest. The dog man had been with him until a moment before, he was sure, but there wasn't any sign of him now. As for the others, there was no telling. Some leader, getting split up from his boys like that. He should have been trying to get back, but the Shankar were all around. He could feel them moving between the trees. His nose was full of the smell of them. Sounded as if there was some shouting somewhere on his left, fighting, maybe. Logan crept slowly to his feet, trying to stay quiet. A twig snapped and he whipped round. There was a spear coming at him. A cruel-looking spear coming at him fast with a Shankar on the other end of it. "Shit!" said Logan. He threw himself to one side, slipped and fell on his face, rolled away, thrashing through the brush, expecting the spear through his back at any moment. He scrambled up, breathing hard. He saw the bright point poking at him again, dodged out of the way, slithered behind a big tree trunk. He peered out, and the flathead hissed and stabbed at him. He showed himself on the other side just for a moment, then ducked away, jumped round the tree, and swung the axe down, roaring loud as he could. There was a crack as the blade buried itself deep in the Shankar's skull. Lucky that, but then Logan reckoned he was due a little luck. The flathead stood there, blinking at him. Then it started to sway from side to side, blood dribbling down its face. Then it dropped like a stone, dragging the axe from Logan's fingers, thrashing around on the ground at his feet. He tried to grab hold of his axe handle, but the Shankar still somehow had a grip on its spear, and the point was flailing around in the air. "Gah!" squawked Logan as the spear cut a nick in his arm. He felt a shadow fall across his face. Another flathead, a damn big one. Already in the air, arms outstretched. No time to get the axe, no time to get out of the way. Logan's mouth opened, but there was no time to say anything. What do you say at a time like that? They crashed to the wet ground together, rolled together through the dirt and the thorns and the broken branches, tearing and punching and growling at each other. A tree root hit Logan in the head hard and made his ears ring. He had a knife somewhere, but he couldn't remember where. They rolled on and on, downhill, the world flipping and flipping around, Logan trying to shake the fuzz out of his head and throttle the big flathead at the same time. There was no stopping. It had seemed a clever notion to pitch camp near the gorge. No chance of anyone sneaking up behind. Now, as Logan slid over the edge of the cliff on his belly, the idea lost much of its appeal. His hands scrabbled at the wet earth. Only dirt and brown pine needles. His fingers clutched at nothing. He was beginning to fall. He let go a little whimper. His hands closed around something, a tree root sticking out from the earth at the very edge of the gorge. He swung in space, gasping, but his grip was firm. "Ha!" he shouted. "Ha!" He was still alive. It would take more than a few flatheads to put an end to Logan Ninefingers. He started to pull himself up onto the bank, but couldn't manage it. There was some great weight around his legs. He peered down. The gorge was deep, very deep, with sheer rocky sides. Here and there a tree clung to a crack, growing out into the empty air and spreading its leaves into space. The river hissed away far below, fast and angry, foaming white water fringed by jagged black stone. That was all bad, for sure, But the real problem was closer to hand. The big Shankar was still with him, swinging gently back and forth with its dirty hands clamped tight around his left ankle.
"Shit,"
muttered Logan. It was quite a scrape he was in. He'd been in some bad ones, all right, and lived to sing the songs, but it was hard to see how this could get much worse. That got him thinking about his life. It seemed a bitter, pointless sort of a life now. No one was any better because of it. Full of violence and pain, with not much but disappointment and hardship in between. His hands were starting to tire now, his forearms were burning. The big flathead didn't look like it was going to fall off any time soon. In fact, it had dragged itself up his leg away. It paused, glaring up at him. If Logan had been the one clinging to the Shankar's foot, he would most likely have thought, "My life depends on this leg I'm hanging from. Best not take any chances. A man would rather save himself than kill his enemy." Trouble was that the Shankar didn't think that way, and Logan knew it. So it wasn't much of a surprise when it opened its big mouth and sank its teeth into his calf.
"Ah!"
Logan grunted and squealed and kicked out as hard as he could with his bare heel, kicked a bloody gash in the Shankar's head, but it wouldn't stop biting, and the harder he kicked, the more his hands slipped on the greasy root above. There wasn't much root left to hold on to now, and what there was looked like snapping off any moment. He tried to think past the pain in his hands, the pain in his arms, the flathead's teeth in his leg. He was going to fall. The only choice was between falling on rocks or falling on water, and that was a choice that more or less made itself. Once you've got a task to do, it's better to do it than to live with the fear of it. That's what Logan's father would have said. So he planted his free foot firmly on the rock face, took one last deep breath, and flung himself out into empty space with all the strength he had left. He felt the biting teeth let go of him, then the grasping hands, and for a moment he was free. Then he began to fall. Fast. The sides of the gorge flashed past, grey rock, green moss, patches of white snow, all tumbling around him. Logan turned over slowly in the air, limbs flailing pointlessly, too scared to scream. The rushing wind whipped at his eyes, tugged at his clothes, plucked the breath out of his mouth. He saw the big Shankar hit the rock face beside him. He saw it break and bounce and flop off, dead for sure. That was a pleasing sight, but Logan's satisfaction was short-lived. The water came up to meet him. It hit him in the side like a charging bull, punched the air out of his lungs, knocked the sense out of his head, sucked him in and down into the cold darkness. Part 1. The blade itself incites to deeds of violence. Homer. Chapter 1. The Survivors. The lapping of water in his ears. That was the first thing. The lapping of water, the rustling of trees, the odd click and twitter of a bird. Logan opened his eyes a crack. Light, blurry bright through leaves. This was death? Then why did it hurt so much? His whole left side was throbbing. He tried to take a proper breath, choked, coughed up water, spat out mud. He groaned, flopped over onto his hands and knees, dragged himself up out of the river, gasping through clenched teeth, rolled onto his back in the moss and slime and rotten sticks at the water's edge. He lay there for a moment, staring up at the grey sky beyond the black branches, breath wheezing in his raw throat.
"I am still alive," he croaked to himself.
Still alive. In spite of the best efforts of nature, Shankar, men and beasts, soaking wet and flat on his back, he started to chuckle. Reedy, gurgling laughter. Say one thing for Logan Ninefingers, say he's a survivor. A cold wind blew across the rotting riverbank, and Logan's laughter slowly died. Alive he might be, but staying alive, that was another question. He sat up, wincing at the pain. He tottered to his feet, leaning against the nearest tree trunk. He scraped the dirt out of his nose, his eyes, his ears. He pulled up his wet shirt to take a look at the damage. His side was covered in bruises from the fall, blue and purple stains all up his ribs. Tender to the touch and no mistake, but it didn't feel like anything was broken. His leg was a mess, torn and bloody from the shanker's teeth. It hurt bad, but his foot still moved well enough, and that was the main thing. He'd need his foot if he was going to get out of this. He still had his knife in the sheath at his belt, and he was mightily glad to see it. You could never have too many knives in Logan's experience, and this was a good one. But the outlook was still bleak. He was on his own, in woods crawling with flatheads. He had no idea where he was, but he could follow the river. The rivers all flowed north, from the mountains to the cold sea. Follow the river southwards against the current. Follow the river and climb up into the high places where the shanker couldn't find him. That was his only chance. It would be cold up there this time of year, deadly cold. He looked down at his bare feet. It was just his luck that the shanker had come while he had his boots off, trimming his blisters. No coat, either. He'd been sitting near the fire. Like this, he wouldn't last a day in the mountains. His hands and feet would turn black in the night, and he'd die bit by bit before he even reached the passes, if he didn't starve first. Shit, he muttered. He had to go back to the camp. He had to hope the flatheads had moved on, hoped they'd left something behind, something he could use to survive. That was an awful lot of hoping, but he had no choice. He never had any choices. It had started to rain by the time Logan found the place, spitting drops that plastered his hair to his skull, kept his clothes wet through. He pressed himself against a mossy trunk and peered out towards the camp, heart pounding, fingers of his right hand curled painful tight around the slippery grip of his knife. He saw the blackened circle where the fire had been, half-burned sticks and ash trampled round it. He saw the big log Three Trees and Dow had been sitting on when the flatheads came. He saw odd bits of torn and broken gear scattered across the clearing. He counted three dead shanker crumpled on the ground, one with an arrow poking out of its chest. Three dead ones, but no sign of any alive. That was lucky. Just lucky enough to survive, as always. Still, they might be back at any moment. He had to be quick. Logan scuttled out from the trees, casting about on the ground. His boots were still there where he'd left them. He snatched them up and dragged them onto his freezing feet, hopping around, almost slipping in his haste. His coat was there too, wedged under the log, battered and scarred from 10 years of weather and war, torn and stitched back together, missing half a sleeve. His pack was lying shapeless in the brush nearby, its contents strewn out down the slope. He crouched, breathless, throwing it all back inside. A length of rope, his old clay pipe, some strips of dried meat, needle and twine, a dented flask with some liquor still sloshing inside. All good, all useful. There was a tattered blanket snagged on a branch, wet and half-caked in grime. Logan pulled it up and grinned. His old, battered cookpot was underneath, lying on its side, kicked off the fire in the fight, maybe. He grabbed hold of it with both hands. It felt safe, familiar, dented and blackened from years of hard use. He'd had that pot a long time. It had followed him all through the wars, across the north and back again. They had all cooked in it together, out on the trail, all eaten out of it. Fawley, Grim, the dog man, all of them. Logan looked over the campsite again. Three dead shanker, but none of his people. Maybe they were still out there. Maybe if he took a risk, tried to look. No, he said it quietly under his breath. He knew better than that. There had been a lot of flatheads, an awful lot. He had no idea how long he'd lain on the riverbank. Even if a couple of the boys had got away, the shanker would be hunting them, hunting them down in the forests. They were nothing but corpses now, for sure, scattered across the high valleys. All Logan could do was make for the mountains and try to save his own sorry life. You have to be realistic. Have to be, however much it hurts.
"It's just you and me now," said Logan, as he stuffed the pot into his pack and threw it over his shoulder.
He started to limp off as fast as he could, uphill towards the river, towards the mountains. Just the two of them, him and the pot. They were the only survivors.
Chapter 2 Questions.
"Why do I do this?"
Inquisitor Glockter asked himself for the thousandth time as he limped down the corridor. The walls were rendered and whitewashed, though none too recently. There was a seedy feel to the place and a smell of damp. There were no windows, as the hallway was deep beneath the ground, and the lanterns cast slow flowing shadows into every corner.
Why would anyone want to do this?
Glockter's walking made a steady rhythm on the grimy tiles of the floor. First the confident click of his right heel, then the tap of his cane, then the endless sliding of his left foot, with the familiar stabbing pains in the ankle, knee, arse, and back. Click, tap, pain. That was the rhythm of his walking. The dirty monotony of the corridor was broken from time to time by a heavy door, bound and studded with pitted iron. On one occasion, Glockter thought he heard a muffled cry of pain from behind one.
"I wonder what poor fool is being questioned in there, what crime they are guilty or innocent of, what secrets are being picked at, what lies cut through, what treasons laid bare."
He didn't wonder long, though. He was interrupted by the steps. If Glockter had been given the opportunity to torture any one man, anyone at all, he would surely have chosen the inventor of steps. When he was young and widely admired, before his misfortunes, he had never really noticed them. He had sprung down them two at a time and gone blithely on his way. No more.
They're everywhere. You really can't change floors without them. And down is worse than up. That's the thing people never realize. Going up, you usually don't fall that far.
He knew this flight well. 16 steps cut from smooth stone, a little worn toward the center, slightly damp, like everything down here. There was no banister, nothing to cling to.
16 enemies, a challenge indeed.
It had taken Glockter a long time to develop the least painful method of descending stairs. He went sideways like a crab.
Cane first, then left foot, then right,
with more than the usual agony as his left leg took his weight, joined by a persistent stabbing in the neck.
"Why should it hurt in my neck when I go downstairs? Does my neck take my weight? Does it?"
Yet the pain could not be denied. Glockter paused 4 steps from the bottom. He had nearly beaten them. His hand was trembling on the handle of his cane, his left leg aching like fury. He tongued his gums where his front teeth used to be, took a deep breath, and stepped forward. His ankle gave way with a horrifying wrench, and he plunged into space, twisting, lurching, his mind a cauldron of horror and despair. He stumbled onto the next step like a drunkard, fingernails scratching at the smooth wall, giving a squeal of terror.
"You stupid, stupid bastard!"
His cane clattered to the floor, his clumsy feet wrestled with the stones, and he found himself at the bottom, by some miracle still standing.
And here it is, that horrible, beautiful, stretched-out moment between stubbing your toe and feeling the hurt. How long do I have before the pain comes? How bad will it be when it does?
Gasping, slack-jawed at the foot of the steps, Glockter felt a tingling of anticipation.
Here it comes.
The agony was unspeakable, a searing spasm up his left side from foot to jaw. He squeezed his watering eyes tight shut, clamped his right hand over his mouth so hard that the knuckles clicked. His remaining teeth grated against each other as he locked his jaws together, but a high-pitched, jagged moan still whistled from him.
Am I screaming or laughing? How do I tell the difference?
He breathed in heaving gasps through his nose, snot bubbling out onto his hand, his twisted body shaking with the effort of staying upright. The spasm passed. Glockter moved his limbs cautiously, one by one, testing the damage. His leg was on fire, his foot numb, his neck clicked with every movement, sending vicious little stings down his spine.
Pretty good, considering.
He bent down with an effort and snatched up his cane between two fingers, drew himself up once more, wiped the snot and tears on the back of his hand.
Truly a thrill. Did I enjoy it?
For most people, stairs are a mundane affair. For me, an adventure. He limped off down the corridor, giggling quietly to himself. He was still smiling ever so faintly when he reached his own door and shuffled inside. A grubby white box with two doors facing each other. The ceiling was too low for comfort, the room too brightly lit by blazing lamps. Damp was creeping out of one corner, and the plaster had erupted with flaking blisters, speckled with black mould. Someone had tried to scrub a long bloodstain from one wall, but hadn't tried nearly hard enough. Practical Frost was standing on the other side of the room, big arms folded across his big chest. He nodded to Glockter, with all the emotion of a stone, and Glockter nodded back. Between them stood a scarred, stained wooden table, bolted to the floor and flanked by two chairs. A naked, fat man sat in one of them, hands tied tightly behind him and with a brown canvas bag over his head. His quick, muffled breathing was the only sound. It was cold down here, but he was sweating. As well he should be. Glockter limped over to the other chair, leaned his cane carefully against the edge of the tabletop, and slowly, cautiously, painfully, sat down. He stretched his neck to the left and right, then allowed his body to slump into a position approaching comfort. If Glockter had been given the opportunity to shake the hand of any one man, anyone at all, he would surely have chosen the inventor of chairs.
He has made my life almost bearable.
Frost stepped silently out of the corner and took hold of the loose top of the bag between meaty, pale finger and heavy white thumb. Glockter nodded, and the practical ripped it off, leaving Salem Ruse blinking in the harsh light.
A mean, piggy, ugly little face. You mean, ugly pig, Ruse. You disgusting swine. You're ready to confess right now, I'll bet. Ready to talk and talk without interruption until we're all sick of it.
There was a big dark bruise across his cheek and another on his jaw above his double chin. As his watering eyes adjusted to the brightness, he recognized Glockter sitting opposite him and his face suddenly filled with hope.
A sadly, sadly misplaced hope.
Glockter! You have to help me!
He squealed, leaning forward as far as his bonds would allow, words bubbling out in a desperate, mumbling mess.
I'm falsely accused, you know it. I'm innocent. You've come to help me, yes? You're my friend. You have influence here. We're friends, friends. You could say something for me. I'm an innocent man, falsely accused. I'm...
Glockter held up his hand for silence. He stared at Rue's familiar face for a moment, as though he had never laid eyes on him before. Then he turned to Frost.
Am I supposed to know this man?
The albino said nothing. The bottom part of his face was hidden by his practical's mask, and the top half gave nothing away. He stared unblinking at the prisoner in the chair, pink eyes as dead as a corpse. He hadn't blinked once since Glockter came into the room.
How can he do that?
It's me, Ruse!
Hissed the fat man, the pitch of his voice rising steadily towards panic.
"Salem Rose, you know me, Glockter. I was with you in the war before, you know, we're friends, we..."
Glockter held up his hand again and sat back, tapping one of his few remaining teeth with a fingernail, as though deep in thought.
"Rose, the name is familiar. A merchant, a member of the Guild of Mercers. A rich man, by all accounts. I remember now."
Glockter leaned forward, pausing for effect.
"He was a traitor. He was taken by the Inquisition, its property confiscated. You see, he had conspired to avoid the king's taxes."
Rue's mouth was hanging open.
"The king's taxes!"
screamed Glockter, smashing his hand down on the table. The fat man stared wide-eyed and licked at a tooth. Upper right side, second from the back.
"But where are our manners?"
asked Glockter of no one in particular.
"We may or may not have known each other once, but I don't think you and my assistant have been properly introduced. Practical Frost, say hello to this fat man."
It was an open-handed blow, but powerful enough to knock Ruse clean out of his seat. The chair rattled, but was otherwise unaffected.
"How is that done? To knock him to the ground but leave the chair standing?"
Ruse sprawled, gurgling across the floor, face flattened on the tiles.
"He reminds me of a beached whale," said Glockter absently.
The albino grabbed Ruse under the arm and hauled him up, flung him back into the chair. Blood seeped from a cut on his cheek, but his piggy eyes were hard now.
"Blows make most men soften up, but some men harden. I never would have taken this one for a tough man, but life is full of surprises."
Ruse spat blood onto the tabletop.
"You've gone too far here, Glockter. Oh, yes, the Mercers are an honourable guild. We have influence. They won't put up with this. I'm a known man. Even now, my wife will be petitioning the king to hear my case."
"Ah, your wife,"
Glockter smiled sadly.
"Your wife is a very beautiful woman. Beautiful and young. I fear, perhaps, a little too young for you. I fear she took the opportunity to be rid of you. I fear she came forward with your books. All the books."
Rue's face paled.
"We looked at those books."
Glockter indicated an imaginary pile of papers on his left.
"We looked at the books in the treasury,"
indicating another on his right.
"Imagine our surprise when we could not make the numbers add up. And then there were the nighttime visits by your employees to warehouses in the old quarter, the small unregistered boats, the payments to officials, the forged documentation." "Must I go on?"
asked Glockter, shaking his head in profound disapproval. The fat man swallowed and licked his lips. Pen and ink were placed before the prisoner, and the paper of confession, filled out in detail in Frost's beautiful, careful script, awaiting only the signature.
"I'll get him right here and now." "Confess, Rules,"
Glockter whispered softly,
"and put a painless end to this regrettable business. Confess and name your accomplices. We already know who they are. It will be easier on all of us. I don't want to hurt you, believe me. It will give me no pleasure. Nothing will. Confess. Confess, and you will be spared. Exile in Angland is not so bad as they would have you believe. There is still pleasure to be had from life there, and the satisfaction of a day's honest work in the service of your king. Confess."
Ruse stared at the floor, licking at his tooth. Glockter sat back and sighed.
"Or not," he said, "and I can come back with my instruments.
Frost moved forward, his massive shadow falling across the fat man's face.
"Body found floating by the docks," Glockter breathed. "Bloated by seawater and horribly mutilated. Far, far beyond recognition."
"He's ready to talk. He's fat and ripe and ready to burst."
"Were the injuries inflicted before or after death?" he asked the ceiling breezily. "Was the mysterious deceased a man or a woman, even?"
Glockter shrugged.
"Who can say?"
There was a sharp knock at the door. Rue's face jerked up, filled with hope again.
"Not now, damn it."
Frost went to the door, opened it a crack. Something was said. The door shut. Frost leaned down to whisper in Glockter's ear.
"It's Severall,"
came the half-tongued mumble, by which Glockter understood that Severard was at the door.
Already?
Glockter smiled and nodded, as if it was good news. Rue's face fell a little. How could a man whose business had been concealment find it impossible to hide his emotions in this room? But Glockter knew how. It's hard to stay calm when you're terrified, helpless, alone, at the mercy of men with no mercy at all. Who could know that better than me? He sighed, and using his most world-weary tone of voice, asked,
"Do you wish to confess?"
"No!"
The defiance had returned to the prisoner's piggy eyes now. He stared back, silent and watchful, and sucked.
"Surprising. Very surprising. But then, we're just getting started." "Is that tooth bothering you, Ruth?"
There was nothing Glockter didn't know about teeth. His own mouth had been worked on by the very best, or the very worst, depending on how you look at it.
"It seems that I must leave you now, but while I'm away, I'll be thinking about that tooth. I'll be considering very carefully what to do with it."
He took hold of his cane.
"I want you to think about me thinking about your tooth. And I also want you to think very carefully about signing your confession."
Glockter got awkwardly to his feet, shaking out his aching leg.
"I think you may respond well to a straightforward beating, however, so I'm going to leave you in the company of Practical Frost for half an hour."
Rue's mouth became a silent circle of surprise. The albino picked up the chair, fat man and all, and turned it slowly around.
"He's absolutely the best there is at this kind of thing."
Frost took out a pair of battered leather gloves and began to pull them carefully onto his big white hands, one finger at a time.
"You always did like to have the very best of everything, eh, Ruth?"
Glockter made for the door.
"Wait, Glockter!"
wailed Ruth over his shoulder.
"Wait, I..."
Practical Frost clamped a gloved hand over the fat man's mouth and held a finger to his mask. "Shh," he said. The door clicked shut. Severard was leaning against the wall in the corridor, one foot propped on the plaster behind him, whistling tunelessly beneath his mask and running a hand through his long, lanky hair. As Glockter came through the door, he straightened up and gave a little bow, and it was plain by his eyes that he was smiling. He's always smiling.
"Superior Kalheim wants to see you," he said in his broad, common accent, "and I'm of the opinion that I never saw him angrier."
"Severard, you poor thing, you must be terrified. Do you have the box?"
"I do."
"And you took something out for Frost?"
"I did."
"And something for your wife, too, I hope."
"Oh, yes," said Severard, his eyes smiling more than ever. "My wife will be well taken care of, if I ever get one."
"Good. I hasten to answer the call of the superior. When I have been with him for 5 minutes, come in with the box."
"Just barge into his office."
"Barge in and stab him in the face, for all I care."
"I'd consider that done, Inquisitor." Glockter nodded, turned away, then turned back.
Don't really stab him, Aetheverard.
The practical smiled with his eyes and sheathed his vicious-looking knife. Glockter rolled his eyes up to the ceiling, then limped off, his cane tapping on the tiles, his leg throbbing. Click, tap, pain. That was the rhythm of his walking. The superior's office was a large and richly appointed room high up in the House of Questions, a room in which everything was too big and too fancy. A huge, intricate window dominated one wood-panelled wall, offering a view over the well-tended gardens in the courtyard below. An equally huge and ornate desk stood in the centre of a richly coloured carpet from somewhere warm and exotic. The head of a fierce animal from somewhere cold and exotic was mounted above a magnificent stone fireplace with a tiny mean fire, close to burning out, inside. Superior Kaline himself made his office look small and drab. A vast, florid man in his late 50s, he had overcompensated for his thinning hair with magnificent white side whiskers. He was considered a daunting presence, even within the Inquisition. But Glockter was past scaring, and they both knew it. There was a big, fancy chair behind the desk, but the superior was pacing up and down while he screamed, his arms waving. Glockter was seated on something which, while doubtless expensive, had clearly been designed to make its occupant as uncomfortable as possible.
It doesn't bother me much, though. Uncomfortable is as good as I ever get.
He amused himself with the thought of Kaline's head mounted above the fireplace, instead of that fierce animal's, while the superior ranted at him.
He's every bit like his fireplace, the big dolt. Looks impressive, but there's not much going on underneath. I wonder how he'd respond to an interrogation. I'd start with those ridiculous side whiskers.
But Glockter's face was a mask of attention and respect.
Well, you've outdone yourself this time, Glockter, you mad cripple. When the Mercers find out about this, they'll have you flayed.
I've tried flaying. It tickles. Damn it, keep your mouth shut and smile. Where's that whistling fool Severard? I'll have him flayed when I get out of here.
Oh, yes, that's good. That's very good, Glockter. Look at me laugh. And evasion of the king's taxes?
The superior glowered down, whiskers bristling.
The king's taxes!
He screamed, spraying Glockter with spit.
They're all at it! The Mercers, the Spicers, all of them! Every damn fool with a boat!
But this was so open, Superior. It was an insult to us. I felt we had to—
You felt?
Kaline was red-faced and vibrating with rage.
You were explicitly told to keep away from the Mercers, away from the Spicers, away from all the big guilds.
He strode up and down with ever greater speed.
You'll wear your carpet out at this rate. The big guilds will have to buy you a new one.
You felt, did you? Well, he'll have to go back. We'll have to release him, and you'll have to feel your way to a grovelling apology. It's a damn disgrace. You've made me look ridiculous. Where is he now?
I left him in the company of Practical Frost.
With that mumbling animal?
The superior tore at his hair in desperation.
Well, that's it then, isn't it? He'll be a ruin now. We can't send him back in that condition. You're finished here, Glockter. Finished. I'm going straight to the Archlector. Straight to the Archlector.
The huge door was kicked open, and Severard sauntered in carrying a wooden box. And not a moment too soon. The superior stared, speechless, open-mouthed with wrath, as Severard dropped it on the desk with a thump and a jingle.
What the hell is the meaning of—
Severard pulled open the lid, and Kaline saw the money. All that lovely money. He stopped in mid-rant, mouth stuck, forming the next sound. He looked surprised, then he looked puzzled, then he looked cautious. He pursed his lips and slowly sat down.
Thank you, practical Thevrard, said Glockter. You may go.
The superior was stroking thoughtfully at his side whiskers as Thevrard strolled out, his face returning gradually to its usual shade of pink.
Confiscated from Ruth. The property of the crown now, of course. I thought I should give it to you as my direct superior so that you could pass it on to the treasury.
Or buy a bigger desk, you leech. Glockter leaned forward, hands on his knees.
You could say, perhaps, that Ruth went too far, that questions had been asked, that an example had to be made. We can't be seen to do nothing after all. It'll make the big guilds nervous, keep them in line.
It'll make them nervous, and you can screw more out of them.
Or you could always tell them that I'm a mad cripple and blame me for it.
The superior was starting to like it now, Glockter could tell. He was trying not to show it, but his whiskers were quivering at the sight of all that money.
All right, Glockter. All right. Very well.
He reached out and carefully shut the lid of the box.
But if you ever think of doing something like this again, talk to me first, would you? I don't like surprises.
Glockter struggled to his feet, limped towards the door.
Oh, and one more thing.
He turned stiffly back. Kayline was staring at him severely from beneath his big, fancy brows.
When I go to see the Mercers, I'll need to take Rue's confession.
Glockter smiled broadly, showing the yawning gap in his front teeth.
That shouldn't be a problem, Superior.
Kayline had been right. There was no way that Ruse could have gone back in this condition. His lips were split and bloody, his sides covered in darkening bruises, his head lolled sideways, face swollen almost past recognition. In short, he looks like a man ready to confess.
I don't imagine you enjoyed the last half hour, Ruse. I don't imagine you enjoyed it much at all. Perhaps it was the worst half-hour of your life, I really couldn't say. I'm thinking about what we have for you here, though, and the sad fact is, that's about as good as it gets. That's the high life.
Glockter leaned forward, his face just inches from the bloody pulp of Rue's nose.
Practical Froth, the little girl compared to me, he whispered. He's a kitten. Once I get started with you, Ruth, you'll be looking back on this with nostalgia. You'll be begging me to give you half an hour with the practical. Do you understand?
Ruth was silent, except for the air whistling through his broken nose.
Show him the instruments, whispered Glockter.
Frost stepped forward and opened the polished case with a theatrical flourish. It was a masterful piece of craftsmanship. As the lid was pulled back, the many trays inside lifted and fanned out, displaying Glockter's tools in all their gruesome glory. There were blades of every size and shape, needles curved and straight, bottles of oil and acid, nails and screws, clamps and pliers, saws, hammers, chisels. Metal, wood and glass glittered in the bright lamplight, all polished to mirror brightness and honed to a murderous sharpness. A big purple swelling under Rue's left eye had closed it completely, but the other darted over the instruments, terrified, fascinated. The functions of some were horribly obvious, the functions of others were horribly obscure.
Which scare him more, I wonder? We were talking about your tooth, I think,
murmured Glockter. Rue's eyes flicked up to look at him.
Oh, would you like to confess? I have him. Here he comes. Confess, 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 confess.
There was a sharp knock at the door.
Damn it again.
Frost opened it a crack, and there was a brief whispering. Rue's licked at his bloated lip. The door shut. The albino leaned to whisper in Glockter's ear.
It's the old victim.
Glockter froze. The money was not enough. While I was shuffling back from Kaline's office, the old bastard was reporting me to the Archlector. Am I finished, then? He felt a guilty thrill at the thought. Well, I'll see to this fat pig first. Tell Severard I'm on my way. Glockter turned back to talk to his prisoner, but Frost put a big white hand on his shoulder.
Oh, the Archlector.
Frost pointed to the door.
He's here. No.
Here? Glockter could feel his eyelid twitching. Why? He pushed himself up using the edge of the table. Will they find me in the canal tomorrow? Dead and bloated, far, far beyond recognition. The only emotion that he felt at the idea was a flutter of mild relief. No more stairs. The Archlector of His Majesty's Inquisition was standing outside in the corridor. The grimy walls looked almost brown behind him, so brilliantly spotless were his long white coat, his white gloves, his shock of white hair. He was past 60, but showed none of the infirmity of age. Every tall, clean-shaven, fine-boned inch of him was immaculately turned out. He looks like a man who has never once in his life been surprised by anything. They had met once before, 6 years earlier, when Glockter joined the Inquisition, and he hardly seemed to have changed. Archlector Salt, one of the most powerful men in the Union. One of the most powerful men in the world, come to that. Behind him, almost like outsized shadows, loomed two enormous, silent, black-masked practicals. The Archlector gave a thin smile when he saw Glockter shuffle out of his door. It said a lot, that smile. Mild scorn, mild pity, the very slightest touch of menace, anything but amusement.
Inquisitor Glockter,
he said, holding out one white-gloved hand, palm down. A ring with a huge purple stone flashed on his finger. I serve and obey, Your Eminence. Glockter could not help grimacing as he bent slowly forward to touch his lips to the ring. A difficult and painful manoeuvre it seemed to take forever. When he finally hoisted himself back upright, Salt was gazing at him calmly with his cool blue eyes, a look that implied he already understood Glockter completely and was unimpressed.
Come with me!
The Archlector turned and swept away down the corridor. Glockter limped along after him, the silent practicals marching close behind. Salt moved with an effortless, languid confidence, coattails flapping gracefully out behind him. Bastard. Soon they reached a door, much like his own. The Archlector unlocked it and went inside. The practicals took up positions either side of the doorway, arms folded. A private interview, then. One which I, perhaps, will never leave. Glockter stepped over the threshold. A box of grubby white plaster, too brightly lit and with a ceiling too low for comfort. It had a big crack instead of a damp patch, but was otherwise identical to his own room. It had the scarred table, the cheap chairs, it even had a poorly cleaned bloodstain. I wonder if they're painted on for the effect. One of the practicals suddenly pulled the door shut with a loud bang. Glockter was intended to jump, but he couldn't be bothered. Archlector Salt lowered himself gracefully into one of the seats, drew a heavy sheaf of yellowing papers across the table towards him. He waved his hand at the other chair, the one that would be used by the prisoner. The implications were not lost on Glockter. I prefer to stand, Your Eminence. Salt smiled at him. He had lovely, pointy teeth. All shiny white.
No, you don't.
He has me there. Glockter lowered himself ungracefully into the prisoner's chair, while the Archlector turned over the first page of his wedge of documents, frowned, and shook his head gently, as though horribly disappointed by what he saw. The details of my illustrious career, perhaps?
I had a visit from Superior Kaline not long ago. He was most upset.
Salt's hard blue eyes came up from his papers.
"Upset with you, Glockta. He was quite vocal on the subject. He told me that you are an uncontrollable menace, that you act without a thought for the consequences, that you are a mad cripple. He demanded that you be removed from his department."
The Archlector smiled, a cold, nasty smile, the kind Glockta used on his prisoners, but with more teeth.
"I think he had it in mind that you be removed, altogether."
They stared at each other across the table. "Is this where I beg for mercy? Is this where I crawl on the ground and kiss your feet? Well, I don't care enough to beg, and I'm far too stiff to crawl. Your practicals will have to kill me sitting down. Cut my throat, bash my head in, whatever, as long as they get on with it." But Salt was in no rush. The white-gloved hands moved neatly, precisely. The pages hissed and crackled.
"We have few men like you in the Inquisition, Glockta. A nobleman from an excellent family. A champion swordsman. A dashing cavalry officer. A man once groomed for the very top."
Salt looked him up and down as though he could hardly believe it.
"That was before the war, Archlector."
"Obviously. There was much dismay at your capture, and little hope that you would be returned alive. As the war dragged on and the months passed, hope diminished to nothing. But when the treaty was signed, you were among those prisoners returned to the Union."
He peered at Glockta through narrowed eyes.
"Did you talk?"
Glockta couldn't help himself. He spluttered with shrill laughter. It echoed strangely in the cold room. Not a sound you often heard down here.
"Did I talk? I talked until my throat was raw. I told them everything I could think of. I screamed every secret I'd ever heard. I babbled like a fool. When I ran out of things to tell them, I made things up. I pissed myself and cried like a girl. Everyone does."
"But not everyone survives. 2 years in the Emperor's prisons. No one else lasted half that long. The physicians were sure you would never leave your bed again. But 1 year later, you made your application to the Inquisition."
"We both know it. We were both there. What do you want from me, and why not get on with it? I suppose some men just love the sound of their own voices."
"I was told that you were crippled, that you were broken, that you could never be mended, that you could never be trusted. But I was inclined to give you a chance. Some fool wins the contest every year, and wars produce many promising soldiers, but your achievement in surviving those 2 years was unique. So you were sent to the north, and put in charge of one of our mines there. What did you make of Angland?"
"A filthy sink of violence and corruption. A prison where we have made slaves of the innocent and guilty alike in the name of freedom. A stinking hole where we send those we hate and those we are ashamed of to die of hunger and disease and hard labor." "It was cold," said Glockta.
"And so were you. You made few friends in Angland. Precious few among the Inquisition and none among the exiles."
He plucked a tattered letter from among the papers and cast a critical eye over it.
"Superior Goyle told me that you were a cold fish, had no blood in you at all. He thought you'd never amount to anything, that he could make no use of you."
"Goyle, that bastard, that butcher. I'd rather have no blood than no brains."
"But after 3 years, production was up. It was doubled, in fact. So you were brought back to Adua, to work under Superior Kaline. I thought perhaps you would learn discipline with him, but it seems I was wrong. You insist on going your own way."
The Archlector frowned up at him.
"To be frank, I think that Kaline is afraid of you. I think they all are. They don't like your arrogance. They don't like your methods. They don't like your special insight into our work."
"And what do you think, Archlector?"
"Honestly, I'm not sure I like your methods much either, and I doubt that your arrogance is entirely deserved. But I like your results.
I like your results very much.
He slapped the bundle of papers closed and rested one hand on top of it, leaning across the table towards Glockta.
As I might lean towards my prisoners when I asked them to confess. I have a task for you, a task that should make better use of your talents than chasing around after petty smugglers, a task that may allow you to redeem yourself in the eyes of the Inquisition.
The Archlector paused for a long moment.
I want you to arrest Septan Teufel.
Glockta frowned.
Teufel?
The master of the mints, Your Eminence?
The very same.
The master of the royal mints. An important man from an important family. A very big fish to be hooked in my little tank. A fish with powerful friends. It could be dangerous, arresting a man like that. It could be fatal.
May I ask why?
You may not. Let me worry about the whys. You concentrate on obtaining a confession.
A confession to what, Archlector?
Why, to corruption and high treason. It seems our friend, the Master of the Mints, has been most indiscreet in some of his personal dealings. It seems he has been taking bribes, conspiring with the Guild of Mercers to defraud the king. As such, it would be very useful if a ranking mercer were to name him in some unfortunate connection.
It can hardly be a coincidence that I have a ranking mercer in my interrogation room even as we speak. Glockta shrugged.
Once people start talking, it's shocking the names that tumble out.
Good.
The Archlector waved his hand.
You may go, Inquisitor. I will come for Teufel's confession this time tomorrow. You had better have it.
Glockta breathed slowly as he labored back along the corridor.
Breathe in, breathe out, calm.
He had not expected to leave that room alive.
And now I find myself moving in powerful circles. A personal task for the Archlector. Squeezing a confession to high treason from one of the Union's most trusted officials. The most powerful of circles. But for how long? Why me? Because of my results? Or because I won't be missed?
I apologize for all the interruptions today. Really, I do. It's like a brothel in here with all the coming and going.
Ruse twisted his cracked and swollen lips into a sad smile.
Smiling at a time like this, he's a marvel. But all things must end.
Let us be honest, Ruse. No one is coming to help you. Not today, not tomorrow, not ever. You will confess. The only choices you have are when and the state you'll be in when you do. There's really nothing to be gained by putting it off, except pain. We've got lots of that for you.
It was hard to read the expression on Rue's bloody face, but his shoulders sagged. He dipped the pen in the ink with a trembling hand, wrote his name, slightly slanted, across the bottom of the paper of confession.
I win again. Does my leg hurt any less? Do I have my teeth back? Has it helped me to destroy this man who I once called a friend? Then why do I do this?
The scratching of the nib on the paper was the only reply.
Excellent, said Glockta.
Practical Frost turned the document over.
And this is the list of your accomplices?
He let his eye scan lazily over the names.
A handful of junior mercers? Three ship's captains, an officer of the city watch, a pair of minor customs officials. A tedious recipe indeed. Let us see if we can add some spice.
Glockta turned it around and pushed it back across the table.
Add Septan Teufel's name to the list, Ruth.
The fat man looked confused.
The master of the mints?
He mumbled through his thick lips.
That's the one.
But I never met the man.
So? Snapped Glockta. Do as I tell you.
Ruse paused, mouth a little open.
Right, you fat pig.
Practical Frost cracked his knuckles. Ruse licked his lips.
Sep-dent.